Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of filmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, is Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Hello.
I was about to say, or maybe not. I don't know. Oh, God. Danny King, usually with us, only with us in spirit today. Travel timing, you know, he just couldn't make it. So, in order to fill the massive hole in our lives that Danny King's absence created, we decided to get special guests here for the first time since the Prometheus podcast we did way, way back. Eric Snyder. Eric G. Snyder, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on. I'm always glad to fill any holes. Such as the one left by Danny's absence.
Right, right. And if, you know, we'll talk about your phrasing as time goes on, because we might need to work on that. So you excited to be back? Were you, when you got the email, were you like, ah, finally?
I knew that I'd been on before, but I couldn't remember how long ago it had been. But I guess it was however long ago Prometheus was.
I honestly sometimes forget that that movie happened, so I'm not, you know.
I think the show had just started. I think you were pretty new.
We were pretty new.
Yeah.
Now we're old.
It's all gonna right.
be like our 112th episode.
Ugh. Nice.
Too long. Doing it too long. I'm getting too old for this shit. But today, we will be talking about two movies. The first will be A Most Wanted Man, which I have not had the opportunity to see. So that will be Nick and Eric talking about that. And then Guardians of the Galaxy, which Nick did not have a chance to see. So it'll be Eric and I talking about that. So really, all the people who are usually on this show, none of them will be on for the whole episode, which is just awesome. But that's how we roll here, you know? We roll fast and loose with the rules of podcasting.
Exactly. There you go.
Fuck them. Fuck the rules.
Well, I don't know if there's any cause for swearing, Brian. But
oh,
yes.
Well, I'm sorry. We should just figure out, you know, if there are any other holes that you can fill for us. All right. So just to kick us off, A Most Wanted Man. The newest film by director Anton Corbijn. This is based off a novel by John le Carré, and it stars Philip Seymour Hoffman, as well as, according to the poster, Willem Dafoe, who I literally cannot remember from any of the trailers, as well as Robin Wright, and Rachel McAdams. So, gentlemen, y'all got a chance to see this. I, unfortunately, have not had that chance yet. What, Eric, did you think of A Most Wanted Man?
I think it is a good movie, not a great movie, a good movie. It's one of those sort of low boiling spy movies. This Anton Corbijn, he also made. You remember The American a couple of years ago that had George Clooney?
Yep.
And how that was like people sort of expected. Oh, George Clooney spy movie is going to be all full of action, and then it was not full of action.
Yeah, I remember a lot of people being angry about that.
Yeah, this isn't as action free as that, but it's closer in tone to that than it is to, like, you know, The Bourne Identity or something. It's definitely more about paperwork and methodology and philosophy than about shooting and planning wiretaps and stuff like that. Philip Seymour Hoffman is great in the movie. And it's sad that he's dead. But, you know, what are you going to do? That's what I thought.
Well put. Nick Newman, do you concur?
So Most Wanted Man, I guess I liked it okay enough. Sure. You know, this is a movie that I found myself, as with other John le Carré adaptations, the first act or so, I think, is pretty much devoted to acclimation for the audience, acclimation to characters and their specific traits and how those traits interact with the plot elements and how there are so many plot elements which are meant to cohere and how these pieces are being built, all the intrigue that is going into it, all the organizations, and it can be a lot to take in. And so when I wasn't completely gripped by the first 30 or 40 minutes of this movie, I was kind of okay with that, because I was thinking to myself, well, this is how a lot of le Carré movies kind of go for me. That's sort of how it was with Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, which I ended up completely loving. That's one of my favorite movies of the last few years, really. So I found myself getting much more into the movie's groove in the second act when it becomes a bit more streamlined and the plot elements are kind of being pared down to their most essential elements and having the impact they're meant to have. But by the third act of the movie, I found myself kind of tuning out as much of the build-up from the first caught up with the more centralized focus of the second act. I'm trying to be vague here because we're trying to do this spoiler-free since it's kind of one of two reviews and it happens to be the first review. So when I say all this, I say that, you know, I found multiple things to admire, but I'm also kind of skeptical of Anton Corbijn myself. I've seen three of his features now, which are Control, the Ian Curtis biopic, The American, starring George Clooney, from 2010, and now this, Most Wanted Man. And I don't get the sense that he's a very consistent formalist. I don't think he really does much to elevate his own material, frankly. I think a lot of the visual work in this movie is very literal. I don't think there's much vagueness as to what's happening. Something like Tinker Tailor has a lot of visual complexity. From shot to shot, there's a lot of visual complexity. The way images interact with each other is so fascinating in that movie, and it really plays into the idea of this undercover world, this espionage world where, you know, these men have to keep these huge secrets and it destroys their inner lives. A Most Wanted Man isn't exactly that kind of story, sure, but I think it's dealing in similar territory, and from what's going on behind the camera, it's pretty standard, kind of boring stuff. You know, there's shaky cam, because that's the aesthetic he's decided to adopt, but I don't think it's an aesthetic that has much purpose, because it's not really the sort of situation that demands shaky cam. I suppose there's a sense of verisimilitude to it, but it felt very kind of false to me. It was this weird thing where, I guess, Corbijn, to me, when I watch one of his movies, I kind of, even something like The American, which is meticulously composed, a lot of that feels like, a lot of the interesting elements in that movie feel like they're in the screenplay, and he's not really bringing them out of the material. That's how I feel here, and it doesn't help that this is John le Carré we're talking about, who is one of the great thriller novelists of our time. When I'm going to see a movie based on his work, I have high expectations, which, okay, if I have high expectations, there are things to live up to. But I'm also paying money and taking 2.5 hours out of my time, more than that, really, because then I also have to drive to and from the theater to see this movie. So you better well deliver, and I'm not quite sure how well this delivers. I did enjoy Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance. Of course, I do think it's impossible for that not to be a bit colored, knowing that this is really one of his last complete performances. The only exception is one of two upcoming Hunger Games movies. And pardon any bias I might have when I say I assume that's probably not going to be the most riveting work he's ever turned in, frankly. So it was a pleasure to see him here, and I think that he... I think he carries off this, for one thing, he carries off a German accent very well.
Yeah.
It's a very base thing to say, but it's also a very...
German accents are hard even for German people to do. Very good. The trickiest accent.
They make it impossible to say squirrel.
It doesn't... Is it?
You never heard that? That, like, German people have a lot of trouble saying the word squirrel?
Squirrel?
I assume that's how it would come out, yeah.
Yeah, okay, I could see that. It's a very small performance, I guess, even though physically he's this very big, imposing figure.
He looks like a big, sweaty, blonde potato.
It's a good way of putting it.
I mean, no disrespect to the man. That's what he looks like in this movie.
No, sure. I mean, he would have been probably the first person to agree with that. So it's all fair game. He's a very good force to have at the center of this movie, where he just seems kind of very exhausted with his job. He seems like somebody who doesn't particularly enjoy his line of work. And, you know, it adds a certain sad layer to the movie. And particularly, I won't say what it is, but the final shot of this movie has a much greater impact now, after the fact. It only made me wish more that The Hunger Games was not going to be his last work, because I was thinking for that to be his last shot in film would be terrific. God knows what it's going to be now. But overall, Rachel McAdams pulls off a convincing German accent too, so that's nice. Overall, I was kind of cold on it. If it was if the second act was indicative of the rest of the movie, I would have been pretty fond of it. As it stands, I think the first act kind of catches up to it in the third, and that coherence for me didn't really work. So, you know, mixed on it, let's say.
I agree with a lot of that, and I think it, the movie, I guess there's something very cold and clinical about it. To me, it felt like Corbin wasn't making a spy thriller so much as demonstrating how to make a spy thriller. Like, it's sort of... do you know what I mean? Like, there's this, the movie has this urgent tone, but the story itself doesn't have urgency. There's not...
Right. Yeah.
There even is a ticking clock in the plot, but even that aspect of it doesn't feel like there's any urgency to it. That's what's missing for me is some kind of urgency.
Well, I mean, in an example like Tinker Tailor, that was a movie where I could really kind of sense the web that is surrounding this story.
That movie's a lot more complicated than that story is a lot more complicated than this one, though.
That's part of it, but I also think that Alfredson just did a much better job balancing that and kind of giving a weight to the events. Whereas here, it was kind of like, yeah, it's a small story, which I appreciate, but it's also, when it ends, there's, you know, it has in classic Licari fashion. When it does, I thought it was kind of like Jerry Seinfeld, you know, sipping a mug of coffee and saying, ah, that's a shame. And then that was kind of my reaction to it. Ah, that's a shame. And, you know, maybe that says something about my personality for all I know. But at the same time, Brian, I should cede to you.
I mean, I haven't seen the movie, so.
Oh, okay.
What
did you think of? You looked at the poster, so...
The poster I could do without. The poster's a little bit, nah, you know, not quite as awesome as Tinker Tailor. I do like the set offset effects, so it gives it a nice sense of depth. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of cool. The color palette, you know, is exactly what you'd expect from the same, you know, I assume someone in the same poster league as the person who made the poster for The American. Get some good golds in there. I did want to ask, so, obviously, Nick, you said less than Tinker Tailor, this movie is. What did you like The Constant Gardener?
Like 5 years ago, so it's been a bit. My memory of it was actually kind of similar to how I feel about it is that it was kind of one of those things where I found myself, again, in like the second act of the movie, it had sort of a more streamlined focus, and then some of the naughtier material caught up with it. I don't know if maybe this is a problem that I have with Licari that I kind of don't even realize, because I do like The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, which is a 1960s adaptation of his. As far as I know, the first screen adaptation of his work, even, could come down to... I mean, it might just be a matter of material, because as respected as he is, I know he is not... You know, he has a reputation of not being totally infallible, of occasionally turning out a tale that's a bit undercooked, and you know, again, I don't know if I would necessarily say the material itself is totally undercooked. It could be a compromise in adaptation, because there is some detail that's packed into it, particularly in the performances. One of the supporting roles is Nina Haas, who is a German actress who has frequently worked with the director Christian Petzold. She was the star of the excellent film Barbara that premiered in 2012. Okay. She's a very good actress, and she and Hoffman have this very good back and forth with each other. And there's kind of a lot of history in their gestures and their glances toward each other, and a certain the inflections of certain lines. That to me felt like an instance of actors bringing more out of material than maybe their director could, and again, bringing it out of the material itself. So I wonder if that's in the text, and when adapting it to 2 hours. That could have been effective, because the first 4 minutes of the movie are a bit overwhelming. There is quite a bit happening. There are a lot of threads. There are all these different scenes where completely unrelated are occurring, but although they're not completely unrelated, there is the sense that the scenes kind of feel like they exist in a vacuum a bit, which is a complaint that some people had about Tinker Tailor, which I think is kind of fair, but something about, I mean, Eric, you said that you found the movie kind of cold, and I don't know. I like cold thrillers, but there's a difference between cold and, again, undercooked. And This movie rests like right on that line for me, because there are very good scenes and there are very good moments, but it's kind of a melange.
And overall, I had the same thought about what was the other movie you just said from a few years ago?
Constant Gardner.
Yeah, that same kind of reaction of where I felt like, okay, this is fine, but it's you know, it didn't blow me away. And I then when I say cold, I mean that it. I guess that it left me cold, or that it feels like the director is cold. Like there's not an emotional human attachment to the material.
Interesting. Yeah. I really like the Constant Gardener. I found more and more that I might be one of the few people who like unequivocally thinks that is a fine film.
Well, my recollection when it came out was it was getting lots of acclaim, and then I saw it and my reaction was kind of, okay, that's fine, but what do you mean? So I felt like I underappreciated it compared to as much as I was supposed to appreciate it.
Yeah, I don't remember the actual critical consensus around that. I don't know. I never looked into that. That's weird.
Yeah, that's the impression I have. I guess I could look it up and see. I think I'm right. I mean, I usually am.
I mean, of course. That's why we have you on. Otherwise, I mean, why would we bother? So any final thoughts on a Most Wanted Man? I mean, it's not out everywhere. You know, it's not as easy to find as Guardians of the Galaxy. Is it worth hunting down in theaters, or do you think people could wait for it to hit Amazon Prime or Netflix?
I mean, it's not necessarily the kind of movie that must be seen on the big screen, but I guess what's our unit of measurement? Like how far is it worth traveling for?
That would be good.
How
much of a hassle should I go through to get to this?
If it's playing less than a half hour away, then it's worth going to, I think.
All right.
Yeah, I think if you're curious about it, like I don't regret seeing it, and I also there's also the Hoffman factor too,
right?
Where it's a chance to see a great actor in what's probably going to be his last substantial role. But, you know, that's certainly worth something, and he's very good in it. So to see it, like, in a theater, unfortunately now it's going to be a very rare opportunity to see one of his films in a theater. So for that, you know, I would say if you're curious about it, then it's worth seeing, because I think that it'll have many elements that you sort of anticipate from this kind of thing.
And I just wanted to say that I looked it up. The Constant Gardener did get an 84% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh,
Which is that's actually lower than I thought it was. But it was generally widely acclaimed.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I think that people were still high off of City of God.
Maybe
they got over that by the time Blindness came out. Which I liked Blindness, which is I'm weird.
Yeah. seeing Blindness really helped people get over their fondness for that director, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder how people would react if it came out now after his recent run.
If Blindness came out now?
No, if the Constant Gardener did. Oh. Like, if they would say, oh, he's back! Blindness in 360.
Yeah, maybe. Or now the reaction would be maybe how I felt at the time. Well, this is fine, but...
It's fine, I guess.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Alright. Well, that's the end of our review of A Most Wanted Man. Well, I guess I should say your review, because I didn't really take part in that.
You didn't help at all.
I engendered some discussion towards the end.
Guess.
I'm the guy who told each of you when it was your turn.
That's true.
That's all a host really has to do.
Oh, I also have to mention this tidbit, which I think is amusing.
Okay.
That A Most Wanted Man, based on a novel called A Most Wanted Man, and Corbin's last movie, The American, was based on a novel called A Very Private Gentleman. Which makes them sound like they're companion pieces.
It does.
A Very Private Gentleman and A Most Wanted Man. But they're not. Nothing to do with each other. Isn't that a funny coincidence?
I can get behind that. There's a lot of fodder for jokes in there. Like after Steve McQueen did Hunger and then Shame. It was like, what sensation will he go after next? Like earnestness.
Right.
So this week could be like, you know, his next movie will be a doubtful conversationalist.
Right. First Private Gentleman, Most Wanted Man, an extremely popular girl.
A very dapper chap.
There you go.
All right. Well, Nick Newman, you did not see Guardians of the Galaxy. We're going to be going full spoilers, so you can go if you want.
You're a bad American, Nick.
Yeah.
Everyone else saw it.
A very bad American.
There you go.
The newest film by...
by James Gunn. Before I go, first of all, Eric, thank you for joining us.
Yes, I'm glad to chat with you over Skype a little bit.
Yeah, I'm glad too, because you know, if you weren't here, Nick would sign off and then I would just have to yammer for like half an hour by myself about Guardians of the Galaxy.
And nobody wants that.
No.
Light a cigarette and pull up a bottle of rye and just kind of, you know, spout off while you take a drag, you know.
Right.
Anyway, so thank you, Eric. I'll just throw in a quick recommendation for a movie I watched this week, Richard Fleischer's The Boston Strangler from 1968, which I watched, which is pretty incredible. Probably few narrative movies I've seen that come as close to being outright avant-garde, honestly. So I'll say that Blu-ray is Brian De Palma's Phantom of the Paradise.
Oh, yeah, I keep seeing people tweeting about that.
Yeah, wonderful movie. Great soundtrack, amazing Paul Williams performance. You should see it. So that's that.
I'm curious about that movie. I've never seen it, but I've heard people talking about it.
I bet you'd really like it. It has a lot of piano playing.
I do like piano playing.
Yeah.
Is it actually a good movie, or is it like a Brian De Palma good movie? Like,
is it passion?
Is it good, or is it... wow, this is bizarre and bad and amazing and awesome.
It has a lot of kitsch, it has a lot of camp, but it's not... Right. See, like, I'm not at all a fan of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I mean, it has some good songs, and Tim Curry's fun, but I really don't like it, and particularly kind of like the culture around it. Phantom of the Paradise is, like, the much more accomplished Rocky Horror, I think. Okay. It's funny that they were actually released, like, a year apart from each other.
Right.
In a just world, Phantom of the Paradise would have Rocky Horrors... fame. So it's got that stuff, but it's intentional and it's
okay
handled. So all right, well, see you around.
Indeed. Have a good
see you on the internet.
See ya. Bye-bye.
Bye. Glad we got rid of that guy.
I was about to say, now that the fucking riffraff is gone. All right. Well, yeah, now that Nick is gone and just the men are left, we're going to talk about Guardians of the Galaxy, which is the newest film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It is directed by James Gunn, a director, you know, who up until this point had been doing, you know, pretty small stuff. He did, what was it, Slither?
Slither and then Super.
And then Super, yeah, which I, unfortunately, had never had a chance to see, which I'm still pretty upset about.
And which I unfortunately didn't care for. Slither, I love. Super, I did not care for. And I'm curious now. I think it'll be interesting when people now that are seeing Guardians of the Galaxy, they want to go check out James Gunn's other films. It'll be interesting to see what their reaction is to Super.
That will be amazing.
It's a very divisive movie. So we'll see how that goes.
Indeed. And this movie stars Chris Pratt and Zoe Saldana, amongst many others, including the voices of Vin Diesel and Bradley Cooper. And this is our review. So here is the trailer.
So here we are. A thief, two thugs, an assassin, and a maniac. But we're not gonna stand by as evil wipes out the galaxy. I guess we're stuck together. Partners.
Are you telling me the fate of 12 billion people is in the hands of these criminals?
Oh, yeah.
So Guardians of the Galaxy is a space opera type of thing?
It's a sci-fi comedy adventure?
Sci-fi action comedy?
Yeah. Something like that.
And it ties in... through the Marvel Cinematic Universe in that it takes place in the same universe. And it's obviously helping to set up, you know, whatever movies Marvel wants to come out over the next 20 years. But it's primarily the story of Peter Quill, a young boy who is brought into the far reaches of space and grows up to become a space Indiana Jones thief kind of guy.
Yeah. What do they call them? Ravagers.
Ravagers. Yeah.
The ravagers. Scavengers, basically. Pirates.
Yeah. Scavengers, but they're ravagers.
Yeah.
It's a little cooler.
Yeah.
And so he, on a mission to steal an artifact. He gets the artifact, but then runs afoul of numerous factions of people. One of them is a fanatical militant alien race called the Kree. The other is the Nova Corps, which is a giant police state type of thing, but like in a good way. More like society and like almost utopian living.
Yeah, they're on the planet Xandar. And I think isn't it that the Kree aren't all extremists?
Right, they're a
this guy. There's one guy is he's like the terrorist wing of the Kree.
But we don't see a lot of good Kree.
Well, I know. I don't want to paint the entire race of Kree with the same brush.
Right. No. To all of our Kree listeners, we know that your entire race isn't like that.
And you see the obvious parallels to real life situations and problems and
right, like Yankees fans.
Exactly. They're not all a-holes.
Exactly. Not 100% a dick.
Right. No, exactly. No. High 90s, but not 100%.
Right. There's a little bit of good in there. But anyway, so the movie involves a loose collection of a rogues gallery, let's call them.
I don't think you can describe them without using the term ragtag.
Ragtag. Oh, that's good. Yeah. Bunch of ragtag. That's a ragtag group of thieves and lowlives and criminals and warriors.
Ne'er-do-wells. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, this is like ne'er-do-well central, basically. Like, these people ne'er-do-well.
Ne'er.
And they get together to try to keep this magical MacGuffin orb out of the hands of people who would use it for ill. And so, yeah, that's about it. As you can tell, the movie defies easy plot summary. You could basically say good guys try to keep MacGuffin away from bad guys.
See, I think I already disagree with you.
Really?
I think on the contrary, it is easy to summarize the plot because even the movie is way different from other Marvel films in other ways. Like there's not really superheroes, and it's except for a couple of minor characters that were teased in the Avengers. There's no crossover characters. But what makes this a Marvel movie, I think, is the plot, which is basically, here's this magic thing. It's always either an orb or a rock or a stick or a disc or something.
There was that one time it was just red stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So here's this thing that our guys need to keep out of the hands of the bad guy.
Right, exactly. I mean, and that's the thing. It's like, you've got that, but then they pile so much stuff around it.
The stuff that pile around it is fun, but the story is still fundamentally... that again.
How about this? The plot is simple. The story is more complex.
That's fair.
Into that.
Yeah.
But so in general, what were your thoughts on Guardians of the Galaxy?
I liked it a lot. I had a lot of fun with it. It's definitely the jokiest, the most comedy oriented of these Marvel movies. I mean, they've all been fun. Like, of course, Iron Man is snarky and the Avengers had that Joss Whedon tone, but this is by far the most all out, go for the laughs. Somebody described this as the class clown of the Marvel movies, which I go along with that. It's a good way of putting it. Which is also I think why I didn't love it as a movie, because when it's jokey all the time, it's sort of like, you never quite take it seriously. It seems like if they don't take the villain seriously, if they're cracking jokes when they're face to face with them, then why should I take him seriously?
Right.
Whereas in the other films, I've at least sort of sensed the weight and the scope of the threat. Where this just seems like silly all the time, which is fun, but doesn't have much weight to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I get that. I mean, it is, and this is a problem I've had with a lot of the Marvel films. The villain, weirdly enough, is always the least interesting part of all of these films. The major complaint against Batman has always been that his villains are more interesting than him.
Yeah.
In the Marvel films, I mean, legitimately, for the first couple of scenes that the villain was actually introduced, 100% thought he was of the same group of people that was in Thor: The Dark World.
And which villain are you talking about? Who are you talking about?
The guy. The, Ronan, the Accuser.
So you thought that he was...
I thought he was a dark elf.
Who are the Dark Elves? Oh, those guys. Yeah.
Thor team.
I lose track of them all. And yeah.
Other dark-eyed, vaguely humanoid, living in like a stone temple that's actually a spaceship guy.
Right. Do you remember like who even was the villain in Iron Man 2?
Yeah, it was Sam Rockwell, sort of, but not really, but more like the wrestler.
Yeah. Mickey Rourke. But like, who was his character? Like, the Marvel films have a villain problem. Very interesting.
Yeah, it's so weird that's the thing, and I think it is part of it is because the Marvel films, more than coming up with interesting stories, are really just about being showcases for their heroes.
Yeah, it's these characters who are fun, and in this movie for sure, the most fun I had is when it's the five guardians sitting around bickering and arguing and trying to figure out what they're doing.
I would have been cool with like a real world style.
Yeah.
like every time that they were just hanging out, it was great. It was a fun movie. When the plot would start to kick in and they would have to do a thing to advance the plot, it kind of slowed down for me.
Here's going
to
be some villains with deep voices who are going to stand there and threaten each other and talk about this orb and what they're going to do when they get it. And behold this and mark my words and by this
my people have suffered long enough
all that, and my brain kind of goes to screensaver
a little bit, just a little bit. I tried to keep up. In general, I had a lot of fun at the film watching the Guardians do their thing, but it really was like, it's just, and this is the reason that last week on the podcast I actually said that I kind of wanted to see this movie, but I also was just really exhausted at the thought of going to see it. Because it's like, I will love watching Chris Pratt, you know, be a kind of rakish Indiana Jones Han Solo riff. And I was surprised at how much I liked Rocket the Raccoon.
He was
a surprisingly deep and like heartfelt character.
Mm-hmm.
It was bizarre. And he didn't sound like Bradley Cooper. Like, Bradley Cooper did a voice, which is a lot more than I was expecting from him.
Yeah, he had to do a New York voice, because that's what obnoxious people sound like. They sound like New York.
Yeah, he's Long Island.
They sound like Yankees fans.
Yeah.
What do you want from me?
Again, not all Yankees fans.
Not all.
No.
Hashtag not all Yankees fans.
If we could get that trending. And yeah, you know, there were characters like Michael Rooker is in there for a little bit, and Jimon Hansu, who I love, and John C. Reilly has like two scenes. Glenn Close, bizarrely, is in there for maybe four lines of dialogue.
Looking like Mom from Futurama.
Yeah, she did. Oh my God. And like, those people are fun. That's fine. Yeah. Like, I enjoyed seeing them, but I knew that I was going to have to go through the plot mechanics of a Marvel film, which are not hard to discern.
Right.
And so it really is the type of situation where, if they could just, like, if this is going to sound so weird, but hear me out for a second. If I could see a Marvel film that had no antagonist and was like a Judd Apatow style comedy, I would be thrilled. Like, the Avengers, all their little jokiness was kind of fun. But then there's like the slog of like punching people and running around and trying to save the world. And it's like, well, I know you're going to do it.
After all, what we pay them for.
Yeah.
I mean, you get right down to it. But yeah, I'm totally with you. I agree.
So maybe that'll be their next step.
Yeah.
they'll give us that.
Except that if we get that, then we'll complain that they don't have villains.
Yeah. I'll be like, well, there was no real story there was no guy who's purely black pupils with a lot of makeup on.
I mean, it'll be interesting when they're making 10 or 11 of these a year, when they've done so many of them, that they can start doing what the comics will do, where every now and then there's an issue that's just sort of a throwaway.
Yeah,
sort
like
of
the fan service issues.
Yeah.
Like what if they all went to the beach together?
Right, yeah. We'll have a movie that's really just about the heroes having their own internal squabbles or problems, their own drama, which could also be very interesting. They have very interesting stories with that are just about them without any of the villains.
Yeah, I'm hoping that at some point they'll do the there's like a Marvel Civil War type of thing.
Oh, is
like,
there?
Some of the heroes like are on the side of the government, which is like you have to register.
Ooh.
And then so like Captain America, oddly enough, becomes like a wanted man in America because he refuses to be part of this like registration act.
Not Captain America.
Right.
Oh,
it's
man.
Bizarre. It's crazy. But it'd be interesting. And so yeah. It'd be cool if they got to a point at that. But this whole repetition of the same basic plot. And
also, to get to that point where they could do that, they would need to make a lot more movies, which I don't really want to encourage. I'd rather keep those to a minimum. Let's not overdo it.
But they keep talking about like their stages or phases, I think is what they call them.
Yeah, phases. They have phases.
So like phase two is everything leading up to the next Avengers. And I've already heard talk about what phase three is. And I'm just like, good Lord, guys, come on.
Phase three is the all musical phase, isn't it?
Oh, my God. I hope so.
Be great.
I can't wait for Hulk's musical.
It'll be a smash.
I was about to say Hulk smash, but with an Hulk exclamation smash. Point. And written out in those like light boards.
Right.
But it's weird because I walked out of the movie with a lot of goodwill towards it.
Yeah, it's and a that, lot of fun. You laugh yeah. a lot.
And the goodwill hasn't gone away, but it's just like I started realizing that like none of it had to do with the action set pieces.
You know what it is? I just thought of this. I don't know if this analogy works. It's like Oreos. You love Oreos, right?
Oh, I love Oreos.
Sure. And they have different kinds of Oreos, different flavors they try out now and again. They have a bunch of them right now. And some of those are better than others. But even the best one, it's still an Oreo. So like even if it's a little different this time right. and they put a new twist on it, it is still ultimately still an Oreo, the same Oreo that you've eaten a million times before.
Yeah, no, I got it.
Or in this case, 10 times before, twice a year. Like, it's, you know what I mean?
If Iron Man is a normal Oreo, Iron Man 2 is like one of those mint ones.
No, Iron Man 2 was Hydrox.
Okay, that makes sense. And then the Avengers is like double stuffed. I guess I would say that this movie would be those ones that only come out at Christmas where they're covered in white fudge.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. It's really good. Oh, that is extra sweet, extra tasty, extra funny. But it's still, you know. So if you're tired of the Oreo, it's not going to cure that problem because it is still basically that.
It's still an Oreo. There's still an Oreo in there, but there's so much other stuff around it that it might cover up the Oreo.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. No, that's a good way.
Whereas Thor 2 is like just the cookies. Like someone scraped the cream out and was just like, here, eat this. And then you're like, well, can I get some milk? And they're like, no.
Right. And
it's a problem. It's an issue that I have. Because I was sitting there and I was watching it and I was like, this is fun. But there was that sense of like, I need to, like, this action moment needs to stop. This like mid movie fist fight is just there to establish like the stakes. That can't, like, that has to end so that now I can see them all like try to work up their crack plan, like an Ocean's 11 style caper or something.
Right.
And, you know, if I never see another spaceship crash into a city, I'll be happy.
Oh, my gosh. Leave it to Marvel to make a movie that's not even set on Earth, but still have a scene of a city getting destroyed by a battle.
I mean, yeah, it's in all the trailers. I mean, you know there's going to be a big space battle.
Sure.
But there are character moments that I really liked. And we can get into those pretty much soon, immediately, when we get into spoilers. There are character moments that are so great and like so weirdly brave. And I do like what you said, where like there's no superhero in this.
Yeah. I don't think anyone really has superpowers particularly. No.
It's the Infinity Stone or gem or whatever they call them. And that gives people power, but it's a little bit, and this is actually something I said about the first Captain America movie. What makes it so good and what makes it so fun is the fact that it's not really beholden to the rest of the universe that they've created.
Yeah, and that's what's exciting and unpredictable about this. But this one is that it doesn't feel like, oh, we have to make this tie in with Thor and the Avengers and Captain America and everything else.
Right, and because I don't know how it ties in, there's legitimate moments where I felt like, oh, maybe they will lose.
Yeah.
Maybe this is like the beginning, like if you were watching Star Wars and it was like one where they show the Empire becoming powerful, but not the prequels, but like a good movie where the Empire makes its first thrust and destroys the noble government and then says, we're in charge now.
Right.
And that would be great. This movie doesn't quite go there, which is unfortunate for me. But other than that, I mean, like, I saw it and I liked it. And I would say that if anyone else is interested, they should go. But I mean, it is a Marvel movie, so it's not going to blow your mind on a plot standpoint.
Yeah. And if you're tired of the Marvel movies, then yeah, it is still one of those. But
yeah, but it does have enough dressing, enough of the white fudge on top of it, that it may, you know, you'll be able to eat it without feeling like, oh, here I go eating another Oreo.
Right. Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah, I would give it a C plus, B minus.
I gave it a B.
Okay.
Higher than you, I think. Yeah.
I really hate grading movies like that, but I mean, like, yeah. And I loved Captain America: The Winter Soldier, but that was another one where it still felt a little like that.
Winter Soldier disappointed me for losing most of what had made the first Captain America feel like a different thing.
Like time frame?
Well, I mean, that was a big part of it. No, Winter Soldier felt like, oh, this is another cog in the Marvel machine.
Yeah, exactly. And that, but luckily it was a cog that was like really super important. Like, yeah. Iron Man 2 felt like a placeholder, and yeah. Thor 2 likewise felt like a placeholder, mm-hmm. but Winter Soldier was, like, world-shifting in what happens in that
movie.
Yeah,
that's true.
So it was better than that, and it divorced them far enough away from everything else for long enough that I was able to get into it.
Yeah.
So that's our basic thoughts. We're going to get into spoilers just for a little bit. To talk about maybe some of the stuff we liked or didn't like, and then that'll be that. So, yeah, spoilers for Guardians of the Galaxy. This
Everyone dies.
Literally everyone dies.
Ends with the end of the universe. Yeah, I don't know where they're going to go from here.
It was all a prequel. Mm-hmm. It's crazy, though, that they are able to pull a lot of empathy about these characters. Like, if I saw Iron Man die, I don't think I'd care.
Yeah.
But Rocket has a drunk, impassioned speech about his own life that is actually quite moving.
Yeah, that was that surprised me as well, what they managed to do with him.
Yeah, because at first I'm just like, oh, here's like a Jawa. You know, he's just, there's a raccoon race. And yeah. They're like, oh, I kept expecting something like that. But no, he's like an experiment, and he understands mm-hmm. the oddness of his life. And so things like that really helped to pull me in and make this world more interesting. It felt lived in. It felt real. Dave Bautista as Drax the Destroyer.
He also surprised me.
He was great.
yeah, I know he's been in some other movies, and I'm sure I haven't been impressed by him. Because I don't remember him. And he's a wrestler. You know, what are you expecting? But no, he was, he had really good comic timing and good delivery, good acting. Yeah. I was pleasantly surprised.
And it's under a lot of makeup, which is something that I think does not work for Lee Pace as blank-eyed monster number 6.
Yeah, he's doing a different thing. And I liked Lee Pace in this because he was different. Because he, I think except for one moment near the end, he's never jokey. He's very serious and intense, and that, like, that voice is doing, it's like he's, like, everyone else is sort of winking at the camera, but he's not.
Yeah,
and I kind of like that. That was different.
There's a balance to be struck from that, because sure. There's a difference between not taking, like, when you were saying earlier that the characters never really seem to take anything seriously.
Yeah,
like, you could say the same thing about Han Solo, but it's more like that's his guard against, like, fear.
Sure.
Whereas
yeah.
in this, it's like these people just really don't seem to care.
Yeah, they just really don't take it seriously.
They're like, yeah, we'll be fine.
Yeah.
That last scene, I'm assuming it's the last, like, the literal last moments of Ronan's life that you said were a little bit winking at the camera.
But just where Chris Pratt starts dancing.
That was amazing.
And he says, what are you doing? Which is great delivery. That's like the first time that we've seen that character have the same tone as the rest of the movie, because he's always been very serious and intense except until that moment.
Yeah. What do we feel about these Infinity Stones that are obviously pulling the universe together?
Don't care.
I don't care.
There are more of them. Do they do different things, or they all do the same thing?
They said there were 6 of them.
Right. And now, so did all 6 to obviously, just having one is enough to
do a lot of terrible stuff. Shit.
Apparently, yeah.
We've seen like 3 of them, I think, now with this thing, because there's the Tesseract cube,
right?
Right, that's the blue one. Then there's the red thing, which is the, I think they called it the ether.
Wait, which one was that in?
That was the portals in Thor: The Dark World.
Okay.
And then this one. But it really is like, I get that they really ought to define them a little better, because I just keep seeing explosions.
Well, and the thing is, defining them a little better, I don't think is going to help, because they're still just going to be magic MacGuffins that everybody needs.
Right.
Because they're important. Like, it's never going to matter where they came from or what they do, unless they do something other than what they've been doing, which is be a thing that's dangerous and powerful, and we have to keep it out of the wrong hands.
Right.
And I think that's as interesting as that's ever going to get.
And so do you think that Marvel's trying to build up any kind of, like, threat around them? I mean, like, they're obviously... Or this is the better question. Have the stakes in these movies been so high to begin with that the Power Stones, that's a Dreamcast game?
Well, the Infinity Gems,
are they just, like, they're just, like, another way for everything to be destroyed?
Well, yeah, because the stakes in every movie are, it could be the end of the world.
Yeah.
Whether that's because of an Infinity Stone or from somebody, you know, one of the villains unleashing some other kind of plan. That's always the stakes. So I don't feel so far like they're trying to do anything to establish the Infinity Stones as anything more than MacGuffins. The fact that we hardly know what they are, what they do, they're just, yeah, it's those things. It's what the plot revolves around. Don't worry about it.
And, I mean, because it's obvious that Thanos is going for these things. Thanos is in the movie, and then, like, he's a weird plot thread that, like, is there, but he's not really. He's, like, the Moriarty.
Right.
He's, like, masterminding everything.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, I just feel like this, like we keep saying, this movie was fun, but in terms of building a world that you want to revisit, like, is that, it's not really... Like, I don't
know. No, not as far as building a world. I'm eager to hang out with these characters some more.
Right.
But yeah, I don't care at all about this particular universe or how it fits in with the universe we already knew.
Right.
No, it's another corner of it, but it's really the characters that are the worthwhile part.
Yeah, and I would venture to say that I liked all of these characters, more than anyone else in the Marvel universe thus far, save for maybe Captain America and Black Widow.
Yeah, I thought that I was afraid I might get annoyed by Groot and or Rocket, and I didn't. They did a great job with Groot.
Vin Diesel,
yep. Good for him. And it's so funny
that he's doing
publicity for this movie.
Yeah.
As well, when he says one thing a million times. I love that.
There is some good modulation in there.
There is, that's true. He does give different readings of that one line.
Very well.
It's also the first film he's been in where he really felt like he understood all of his character's dialogue.
Yeah, I made a joke leaving the theater about, like, he's so method that he actually spent the last 15 years giving wooden performances. which is a joke that I'm sure if you looked for it on Twitter, everyone has made already.
Sure.
But it felt cool to me to say.
No, that's good. I can appreciate that.
I got a laugh out of two random friends. It was great. other than that, I mean, we got Zoe Saldana, which we haven't really talked about. She's good, but there's a feeling of almost like, I don't know, like her character is there and then she's got like a sister and they have a kind of half formed thing. But do you notice that like movies sometimes still feel the need to like, if they have a female hero, there has to be a female villain.
Yes. There has to be, 'cause you have to have the two girls fighting at some point.
Yeah.
Yes. I did think of that when we saw her fighting her sisters, like, oh, that's right. That's why there's another girl in this.
Exactly.
Like fight. Yeah.
It's like when they gave Batgirl to Batman and Robin to fight Poison Ivy.
Poison Ivy, yeah.
Because you can't have a man hitting a woman.
Which I guess is not, it is a point worth considering, that how that changes the dynamics. If you're going to have a man and a woman fighting, how you pull that off without doing it wrong. I guess if you just keep it two women, it avoids any of those gender problems.
Uncomfortable questions.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. In general, I felt that her character was pretty underused, and her arc was, like, the least developed of all of them.
Yeah, I assume there's probably more to that in the comics that it came from.
I should certainly hope so. I'm sure in the next three Guardians of the Galaxy movies we'll figure
right.
it out.
Right, yeah, and I'm sure they were probably planting some seeds here, laying some groundwork for next time.
And, to close it out, talking about seeds for next time, Peter Quill, Star-Lord's father.
Yeah, I don't know who that is. Do you know from the comics?
I have not read these comics. I'm sure that my I have a friend, Dan Gavazdin, who actually does a podcast, The Superior Spider Talk. And he's a big comics guy. And so my after I hang up, I'm probably going to text him and just be like, so, Star-Lord's dead. And he'll probably have a whole thing. It's a huge, weird balance that these movies strike, because I'm sure that, like, I mean, like, I got a chuckle at the stinger on the end.
Yeah.
But I, like, usually at the end, I'm just, like, baffled by whatever the hell's going on.
Oh, yeah. It's always some character that I don't recognize.
Yeah. Like, at the end of The Avengers, I was just like, who the hell is that purple guy?
Yeah, it was Thanos, yeah.
Yeah, and then my friend Dan is like, Thanos! And I'm like, what does he do? Like, yeah. Yeah, why does that mean something to me? And then he's like, he courts death. I was like, is that a... What does that mean?
Like metaphorically?
No,
like,
apparently there is a like, specter, a creature that is death in this universe, and Thanos wants to... He's, like, in love with her, so he's trying to create a lot of death, too.
Oh.
So I don't know if that's what's going to happen in the movies, because that would be kind of weird.
That would be weird.
To just have, like, a romantic comedy.
Do they ever get it on? Does Thanos ever have sex with death?
I don't know, maybe.
I'm curious about that. I know who I want to be Star-Lord's father. I want it to be John C. Reilly.
Really?
Just because I think that when they had a scene together, and I thought they have kind of similar, that kind of curly hair, and I could see those two actors being father and son. John C. Reilly and Chris Pratt. They got that same kind of goofy charm.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that works within the universe, but that's my vote. John C. Reilly.
With that.
not the character he played, but actually John C. Reilly.
Oh, just like John C. Reilly.
The actor John C. Reilly is the father of this
So you
character.
Want like Chris Pratt's Peter Quill to come to Earth during like Avengers 6 and run into John C. Reilly and
yes,
him to be like, oh my God, my boy.
Yes. See?
Yeah.
You tear up just thinking about it, don't you?
I am. I'm getting a little misty. So any final thoughts on this before we close out?
No.
All right, good. I'll say the Space Invaders shout-out in this movie was hilarious.
Wait, I don't remember the Space Invaders shout-out.
Oh, it was like when the ships are crashing towards the city, and so all the good guys...
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right.
I was like, are they just straight up doing Space Invaders now? Which is weird because that is now becoming a movie, right?
Probably.
Yeah. Oh my God. Anyway, so that's Guardians of the Galaxy. As you can see, fun time at the movies. Perhaps a little bit rote, you know, as you'd expect from a Marvel film. And but yeah, overall, I'd have to say this is one of my more favorite Marvel films.
Yeah, it's up there for me. I certainly enjoyed it quite a bit.
Do you have like a running rank that you could shout out right now, or
no? I tend to enjoy them or not enjoy them, and then sort of forget about them until the next time.
Yeah, yeah, that's probably where I'm at. Though this is the only one that this one and the Captain Americas are the only ones that I would see more than once, like in a theater. Like if a friend of mine was like, "Hey, I haven't seen this yet. Yeah. You want to go?" I'd be like, "Yeah, I'm down for that again." So
I agree with that.
We can't do it on the hassle meter because, like, you could accidentally walk into a building and see this movie. The amount of theaters it's playing at.
Yeah, this movie is probably playing, within 10 feet of you.
Right now.
Open
your bathroom door. It's probably in there. Okay, so we're going to move on. We're going to quickly talk about what's coming to Blu-ray and if any of it's worthwhile. Luckily, I haven't seen any of these, so this is going to be pretty quick.
All right.
Divergent. Did you see Divergent?
Yeah, it's generic.
Okay. Need for Speed with Aaron Paul.
Long and it was like a too long Fast and the Furious.
That's not good. What about the horror film Oculus?
I liked that actually. It was pretty decent.
Excellent.
Saw that at South by Southwest.
Yeah, I really wanted to see it because I was getting a lot of good press, oddly enough, and that's rare for a horror film.
Yeah, it was a pretty decent movie about a haunted mirror.
God's Not Dead.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, I didn't see it either. I will say that the Full Monty is getting a Blu-ray reissue, so check that out. That's basically it. It is not a heavy week for Blu-rays, so let's move on to what's coming out next week. It's the movie that we all feared, and for our sins we shall get it. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Directed by Jonathan Liebsman, produced by Michael Bay. What do you think about this?
We'll see how it goes. I hear that it's meant for kids, which is as it should be. But right. I feel like people are expecting it to be
PG-13
made for kids. Well, yeah, but I feel like people are expecting it to have been made for people who were kids 25 years ago.
Right. Yeah, they wanted to play into nostalgia.
Yeah, but and I don't know. I haven't seen it yet.
I was surprised to learn that little kids still like the Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, that completely passed me over, the Ninja Turtle craze.
Oh, really?
So I don't really have any strong.
I had like all the turtle action figures. Mm. I had that car that would throw pizzas.
Oh wow!
Which only like 10 years afterwards did I think, wow, that's a really ridiculous weapon.
Right.
They love pizza. Why would they dedicate a pizza to hitting a foot soldier in the face? Didn't matter.
That seems strange. Now, when you put it that way, yeah, I agree.
Right.
Yeah.
Into the Storm is also coming out.
Well, that looks terrible.
It looks
frightfully terrible.
I mean, the trailer was literally just like the money shots.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that.
Didn't
seen
even that pretend to have a actual story.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to that because that looks big and cheesy.
Yeah. See it in IMAX. Other than that, Step Up, All In.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. And then there's a couple of indie films, so that's that. So yeah, I guess I have no idea what we're going to be talking about on this podcast next week, because I have a hard enough time getting Nick and Danny out to see like things like Guardians of the Galaxy. I do not know what kind of sorcerer I'd have to pull to get them to see Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Well... that sounds like your problem, not mine.
It is.
Yep.
Lucky you. All right. Well, that's it. Let's do a real quick recommendation. Give me something that you watched on your own this week in your free time that you think the people at home should check out.
What did I watch on my own in my free time this week? I watched Stir Crazy with Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder.
Oh, okay.
On Netflix. It was the first of their collaborations together. I had not seen it before. And it's very funny. And they were two very different comic actors, but the film did a good job of using both of their strengths. It's definitely worth checking out if you've never seen it. Stir Crazy. Made me laugh.
And that's now on Netflix Instant?
It is on Netflix currently, yes.
Fantastic. I've been a bad cinephile. I've started rewatching Deadwood, so that's where all my free time is going. I'm just gonna give a shout out to Deadwood.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Deadwood's a damn good show.
Yeah, it is.
And you know, in many ways, a lot more cinematic than some of the movies we're getting nowadays.
True.
Yeah. So that's what I'll say. Also, I have been watching The Leftovers on HBO to keep it with that. So I don't know if that's a show that's already on y'all's radar, but you should check it out too.
I haven't watched any of that yet.
It is.
Probably will.
Yeah, I love it. Like I personally love it. It delves into a lot of the things that I love about art and feeling and drama and. But I mean, it can be rough from an emotional standpoint.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
Yeah, so you gotta be ready for it. It's not like Game of Thrones where you're like, maybe I'll see a character I love die, but also like there'll be some good, you know, witty dialogue and like a couple of good fight scenes. It's like, yeah, I just want to be emotionally destroyed.
Right.
It's like a person who cuts themselves to feel anything, but like on an emotional level.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're not really selling it.
It's good, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah, so that's that. So that's all. Eric D. Snyder, why don't you tell us where you could be found online?
I'm the co-host of Movie BS with Bear and Snyder. I play Snyder.
Wouldn't it be fantastic if you did not?
We've talked about switching roles one week, but we realized it would just lead to pain and tears because it would wind up each of us making fun of the other one.
Right.
It would turn ugly.
It would be quickly. Like a face-off when like Nick Cage and John Travolta were basically doing cartoon impressions of
yes,
each other.
Exactly. We would hurt each other's feelings.
A lot of hurt feelings after that movie. That's why they never did anything together again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But yeah, Movie BS with Baron Snyder. I have that show every week where we talk about movies. We're the only movie podcast on the internet. I don't know if you heard.
That's crazy. I was right. Just thinking the other day while I was recording this podcast how awesome it would be to have a movie podcast.
Yeah, no, we're the only ones. So
pretty good.
Yeah,
you really cornered that market.
Got in early. That's the main place I am these days on the internet. I'm on Twitter at Eric D. Snyder.
All right, and of course you can find me at filmstage.com. Also, my personal site, dearfilm.net. And on Twitter, twitter.com/BrianJRowan. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. I would say tune in next week, but, you know, can't make any judgments about quality when we don't even know what the movies are going to be. So stick around and figure it out. It's going to be fun.